Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, we'll be genre jumping like never before, from New Americana to Mozart's Magic Flute, and from New Dimensions in Art to lowbrow, high-concept cinema. Outspoken Troma Entertainment co-founder Lloyd Kaufman says, give art back to the people. And Triad Arts Weekend's Eddie Garcia says, you're pushing on an open door. Then Bethany Chafin sits in with the Party Line's Nora Jane Struthers. Her Nashville-based group was just named Best Band at Colorado's Telluride Festival, and this weekend they're headed to Carolina. And I get my first taste of what's been called rowdy bluegrass with Seven Handle Circus's Colin Vinson. They'll be at Twin City Rib Fest this weekend. And at American Singers Opera Project, the Queen of the Night may scream, abandoned may you be forever. But hey, you're never alone on Triad Arts Weekend, next after this news. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and roots music, film, visual art, and vocal pedagogy are all on the way this hour, beginning with a little New Americana. Bethany Chafin's got the inside scoop on a hot new band that's tearing up the bluegrass circuit and headed to North Carolina.
I walked to school on Monday, and when I stepped in the door, other girls were gathered in a circle on the floor. Their slates and books were resting.
Nora Jane Struthers is a singer and songwriter based in Nashville, Tennessee. She released her first self-titled album in 2010 and went on to play the Telluride Bluegrass Festival that summer, where her group was named Best Band. In April 2013, Nora Jane Struthers and The Party Line independently released Carnival, an album of 14 original story songs, all written by Struthers. The album was produced by Brent Truitt, who's worked with artists such as Dolly Parton, Alison Krauss, and the Dixie Chicks. The songs on Carnival tell the stories of women, and together they are a chronological narrative that flows lyrically from tales of youth to old age. Nora Jane and her band The Party Line are currently on tour promoting Carnival, and they'll be playing in Lexington Friday, June 6th at High Rock Outfitters. Nora Jane spoke with me from the road.
Tonight, keeper of the cards you'll be. She said, Annabelle, tonight, won't you keep the safe for me? When I got home, I crept into
the... You're probably somewhat familiar with our area because you've played Merlefest. The Old Time Fiddlers Convention is in Galax, and Mount Airy Fiddlers Convention. I read that you had attended both of those things. So, yeah, tell me about your experience in this area prior to this visit.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, I've been going to the Galax Fiddlers Convention for over 10 years, every year. I love the mountains. I love the community that comes together at that Fiddlers Convention. And Mount Airy is another one of my favorites. I don't make it to Mount Airy every single year, although I'm gonna try and pop in actually before the festival. And yeah, we had a really good time at Merlefest. It was our first time playing Merlefest, and Merle Haggard was incredible. Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott played one of the best sets that I've seen in, you know, ever. and there were just so many great artists, so it was really fun to be a part of that.
And you've done some work with Tim O'Brien, haven't you?
I was fortunate enough to have him sing with me and play a little fiddle on my first album, which I put out in 2010. And I've actually written with him before, and he's the real deal. It's really been incredible to collaborate with him in a number of ways.
So this is your second album that came out in April called Carnival. And could you describe kind of the feel or the sound of that album maybe versus your first one?
Yeah, you know, I think there's definitely some growth in a number of ways in Carnival. One of the things that's consistent is that both records are composed of my original songs that are all story songs. You know, so there's a strong emphasis on narrative that's sort of based in the American folk tradition as it's manifested in like bluegrass and old time and ballad singing and blues and everything, really. But I think on Carnival, the primary sonic difference is that there are some electric instruments. There's a pedal steel guitar, there's some electric bass, and there's a full drum kit as well. My drummer is Drew Lawhorn, and he's really incredible. He's brought a lot of contemporary appeal to sort of my old-timey songs on that album. One of the other sonic things that I really love about Carnival is that interplay between the open back banjo that Joe Overton is playing and the drum kit that Drew is playing. It's just a really interesting combination. I think that they play off each other well, and it creates a unique sonic landscape.
So you're talking about some new sounds, perhaps, and some of that maybe correlates to some new band members. Could you tell me about the other members of the Party Line?
Yeah, totally. So I've just reassembled my full-time band. We lost some people last year just because they wanted to do other things, and we've been subbing people in for about 6 months, and that's been really fun too, actually. But we've got a full-time lineup together again. So it's Drew Lawhorn still on drums, Joe Overton on clawhammer banjo, fiddle, and pedal steel guitar. And now we have on bass our friend Brian Miller, who's really wonderful. And on electric guitar, we're adding Josh Vanna, who is an incredible musician and really rooted in the traditional country music world. But he like brings this great history to what we're doing.
Mama says, don't you marry no railroad man. He will burn through your loving with lies where he's been. And just when you think he's finally stopped, you'll start again. Mama says, don't you marry no railroad man. Ooh, Mama says, no, don't you marry no railroad man. Mama says, don't you marry no preacher's son with the face of an angel.
You guys must get along well to travel together and play together. And I mean, essentially, you're kind of a family. What's the dynamic, the energy between you all like?
You know, I've been touring full time for the past 4.5 years or so, and you know, it's all about the people that you're with. It's all and that makes it really easy to enjoy the journey. If you're with the right people, you know, you can have a really bad day and still have a great time. That's why I'm so excited about this band. I mean, not only are they incredibly talented musicians, but everybody individually wants to be doing this. And the group dynamic is just really easy. There's not a lot of energy wasted. You know, it's just, for the most part, just pure enjoyment. It's just really great. I'm feeling kind of spoiled.
I'm sure your audience members can feed off that. They can sense it and probably hopefully return some of that energy. Another dynamic that it seems like you and your band work really well is I've noticed, you know, your social media presence and your use of Patreon. And it seems like there's a lot of room for creativity in the way you interact with your fan base and those who want to support you. I'm wondering if for our listeners, you could explain what that's all about.
The easiest way to describe it is that it's a fan funding platform. I'm hesitant to use the word funding, but that's something that people are not familiar with. So if you're familiar with Kickstarter, instead of being based on the creation of one project, this website is for people who are continuously creating content, but also, you know, great for webcomics, great for bloggers, just people that are always creating artistic content. So for me, you know, I'm a professional musician. I make studio records, but, you know, the foundation of everything that I do is my songwriting. And it's always been that, you know, before I had chops as a performer, I felt like I could stand on the quality of my songs. But as a recording artist, I'm only able to record, you know, 12 songs every 2 years just because it's such an expensive endeavor to make a studio record and then promote it. So I have all these songs that nobody gets to hear and that I don't get to use. So on this website, I'm offering essentially a way for people to subscribe to my new and unrecorded songs. And for $1 a song, and I'm going to be posting 2 songs every month in the form of a YouTube video of me playing those songs. And then there are all these like subscription levels. So if all you want to do is just watch a video of me playing the new song, you can subscribe for $1 a song. And if you want to do that, but you also want to get the MP3 download of the new song, then you can subscribe for $3 a song. And if you want to do that and you also want access to a patron-only web concert that I'm going to be doing every single month, then it's $5 a song. So it goes up and up, and I think it's just brilliant because I know for the people who get something out of my writing and get something out of my music, it's just a great way for them to have access and be a part of my continuous process.
Going on a bike ride, so I walk I could go anywhere. It's been such a long time, I'm going on a bike ride. Barbell sings. What a simple thing. Moving on a bike ride, sidewalk on the right side. I could go anywhere. Moving on a bike ride, nothing but the sunshine. I could go anywhere. It's been such a long time.
You talked about the narratives in your songs, and some of them are story songs. And is it right that you have a background in some literature studies?
Yeah, I was actually a high school English teacher for 3 years in Brooklyn before I moved to Nashville.
How do you think maybe teaching or studying stories and literature affect the way you approach telling your own stories?
Any teacher will tell you that teaching is the best way to learn. So I learned a lot teaching my students about what makes a good story and how to break it down and the different literary devices that you can employ to tell that story in different ways. I've been writing songs since I was a kid, essentially, but the first songs that I felt like I could really stand on were songs that had a more well-crafted narrative. And I think that I really rooted myself in the tradition of bluegrass and ballad singing and wrote response songs to sort of, you know, traditional songs. And that for some reason, feeling like I was adding to a tradition and adding my own voice and my own way of telling a story to a tradition, made me feel like it was worth sharing with people.
Take me to the carnival, let me ride the rides, buy me a red balloon. Everything there is to see. I want to see the bearded lady in a yellow dress. I want to pray for the man on the high wire. I want to gawk at the grizzly bear's arabesque and the man who's breathing fire. How does a man breathe fire?
All the songs on Carnival are story songs written from the female perspective, and I was sort of taking a cue from some of my favorite artists and writers like Hazel Dickens and Gillian Welch and Ola Bell Reid and Iris Dement, you know, just adding in stories to sort of the folk American tradition from the female perspective that have been missing. So I felt like I had a reason to be making this art. And it's funny, now I've been transitioning in my songwriting. We're getting ready to record a new record in July, and I've really transitioned in the types of songs that I'm writing, which is a little bit scary, but I think very positive. You know, it's always good to change and grow as an artist. But you know, I've been writing a lot more just autobiographical songs, and I feel like I wouldn't have been able to put these songs out in the world before making my first two records, because those sort of just like, you know, set up a framework and grounded me in, you know, the knowledge of some traditional music. And I feel like that gave me some self-confidence.
So that's exciting. And like you said, I was going to ask is if it's scary to sort of be putting elements of yourself into a storytelling medium. But like you said, you answered that, you know, that doing it this way, you kind of had built the self-confidence in order to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I would add too that also in the songs on Carnival and the songs on my first record, even though they're not exactly autobiographical, there are definitely pieces of myself in them, but it's just a lot easier to put a piece of yourself into somebody else's story, you know, than it is to just tell your own story.
Is it true that there's sort of an arc with the songs on Carnival, that they begin with stories of some younger girls, and then they, as the album progresses, then also kind of the lives of the characters progress too, and then by the end you're telling some stories of older women?
Yeah, absolutely. I looked at all the songs after I was done and thought about how to put them in an order for the record. And I just thought that doing it chronologically would give the album an overall story. You know, there's like these little vignettes and like micro worlds, and then, but overall, it's all a part of one story. So it's sort of a concept album.
Stay up all night waiting for the sun to peek its head just behind that mountain top. And if I get tired, I'll lay right down here in the
singer-songwriter Nora Jane Struthers. She and her band, The Party Line, are currently on tour promoting their newest album, Carnival. They'll be playing in Lexington this Friday, June 6th at High Rock Outfitters. The show begins at 9 and tickets are sold at the door. You can find more information and links on our website, wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. There you can also watch Nora Jane Struthers and The Party Line's newest music video for Bike Ride. For WFDD, I'm Bethany Chafin.
We'll go from lowbrow, high-concept cinema to seven-handle circus. Troma Entertainment's Lloyd Kaufman is working hard to level the playing field for independent filmmakers everywhere. He chats it up with Eddie Garcia. And then it'll be time for some rowdy bluegrass next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, and David Ford will be back in about 10 minutes to talk art, opera, and seven-handle circuses, grass, and roll. But first, let's visit the home of the Toxic Avenger and Nukem High, Tromaville.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin. They teased him. They taunted him. They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste, transforming little Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength. Melvin became the Toxic Avenger, the first superhero born out of nuclear waste.
Troma makes what is often referred to as B-movies, shot on shoestring budgets with healthy doses of harsh language, excessive violence, and nudity, and they're often gleefully offensive. But these films are also filled with political, sociological, and environmental messages, and for independent filmmakers, they have not only been a source of inspiration, but a source of information, as Troma has released books, DVDs, and YouTube videos offering advice on how to make films on your own without major studio support. The co-founder of Troma Entertainment, Lloyd Kaufman, visited Greensboro's Geeksboro Coffee House Cinema, where he screened his latest film, Return to Nukem High, Volume 1. He also engaged in a lively Q&A with the audience and signed autographs and chatted with fans till well after midnight. The outspoken king of low-brow, high-concept cinema sat down with me to talk not only Troma, but the current state of independent cinema, net neutrality, and what it's like to start getting attention from museums, galleries, and film archives. Troma Entertainment has been around for 40 years now. How have you been able to remain so fiercely independent and, you know, staying true to your vision for so long?
Troma's 40 years is all thanks to our fans, and not just our fans, but our air conditioners too, Eddie, and NPR, who've given us a lot of attention. We love movies. Michael Herz, my partner of 40 years, and of course my wife of 40 years. I don't mean that Michael Herz is my wife. I meant my wife, Pat Swinney Coffin. We all love film, and that's what motivates us. If we wanted to make a lot of money, I would have used my Yale education to work at Morgan Stanley and become the head of some inside trading program and make billions of dollars. But we love movies, and that is what motivates us. And our fans are our secret weapon. As you see, we have fans here who are setting up the merchandise table so that I can be Willie Loman. They are dressing as Toxie, although Toxie's real, of course, but they're portraying Tromettes, Toxie, and it's all thanks to our fans that we are here in the wonderful Geeksboro Coffee and Cinema. It's really our fans and the free, open, and diverse internet, which continues to permit innovation, continues to be equal and democratic, and we must support net neutrality for that very reason.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I was curious, you know, you probably don't have the battles with the MPAA anymore, probably so much, because now there's so many different modes of distribution. Or do you still, you know, butt heads with them sometimes?
The MPAA is one of the reasons that the Motion Picture Association of America is one of the reasons that the battlefield is littered with the bodies of dead movie studios, because there was a double standard. They would remove bullet hits from Troma's War, but they would permit Bruce Willis's Die Hard to have any anything they want in that movie. So that is, unfortunately, the independent movie studios are quite dead in this country. What passes for independent is a vassal of the major conglomerates such as Fox Searchlight or Sony Classics. It is almost impossible for a independent movie studio to survive for more than a few minutes.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that a little bit. The Cannes Film Festival, I'd like to know more about the Occupy Cannes movement, which you've said uses the Cannes Film Festival to draw attention to the disparity in opportunity between the mega media conglomerates and independent artists. How has this project developed through the last couple of years?
So we, using Kickstarter, and without net neutrality, there would be no Kickstarter. Our fans raised some money so that the Troma team could go to Cannes and film Occupy Cannes. And Occupy Cannes is a follow-up to our All the Love You Can documentary. We made All the Love You Can in 2003. So it's 10 years later. We want to see how Cannes Film Festival, which is supposed to be the ultimate worship of art or of the cinema art, we want to see how that looks through the prism of an independent company. And Troma is that independent company. And basically what you see is that Troma has absolutely no respect from the Cannes Film Festival, nor do true independent filmmakers. There's absolutely no respect for the individual independent filmmaker unless he, she, or it is partnered with a vassal of one of the conglomerates, or he, she, or it has made a movie that has been produced in association with the governments of France, Hungary, Germany. Unless they're in with a government that has some clout with the festival, you do not have much of a chance of any sort of respect at Cannes. The first time I went to Cannes, I slept on the beach, and 1971, I didn't have money for a hotel. And we had our movie there, and we rented some theaters to show our movie, but we didn't have a hotel, and everyone loved it. The fans thought it was fun. The cops were in on it. It was a festival. It was a rather idealistic, innocent festival. And now it's more, Cannes Film Festival is more about Chopard jewelry and $50,000 dresses and accessories going up the red carpet. They want everyone to be a robot. Only the small number of elites can have the privilege of not being a robot. Mere mortals like I must wear a black dinner jacket. But I guarantee you, if Leonardo DiCaprio goes up the red steps in his underwear, they won't stop him.
One of the many things you're doing to battle this is you've written books about how to make your own movies, and Troma has its own film festival also, and it's coming up soon, right?
We created Troma Dance 15 years ago. You do not have to pay to submit your movies. You can see the movies for free, and there's no VIP policy. So we have a party, and if Mickey Rourke shows up, he's going to have to wait in line. And we've had we've had well-known people show up because Troma's kind of cool, and everybody's equal. So Troma Dance is used to be in the same place and same time as Sundance. It was in Park City, Utah, during the Sundance Festival in the exact same village as Sundance. And it was kind of started as a stick in the eye. We moved after about 10 years. Troma Dance outgrew Park City, Utah, and we moved it to Asbury Park, New Jersey. And this year, we have moved it to Brooklyn, New York, because, again, we decided to step up to the greatest city in the world, New York.
I'd like to go back and talk about Toxic Avenger a little bit. In my opinion, it was the first great superhero movie. Can you take me back to the beginnings of the foundations of that idea and what it was like to start making that and to shoot that film?
Well, Troma has been successful because Michael Herz and I have made films we believe in, and we have broken a lot of rules. And we made, starting in 1974, we made movies like Squeeze Play, Waitress, Stuck on You, The First Turn On, which, by the way, we rejected. We managed to reject Madonna in the first turn-on. How stupid were we? But we did cast Vincent D'Onofrio. That was his first movie. We broke the rule that sex and comedy don't go together. Experts were suggesting that if you're going to put sex in a movie, it's got to be very serious. And we made these hilarious, raunchy comedies before Porky's. And boy, were we right. And thanks to Squeeze Play and Waitress, we bought the Troma building in New York. At any rate, the big studios started making those kinds of movies, like Porky's and others, only they were playing very unfair. They were using big stars and no political content, of course, and no sociological content, but we couldn't compete with the billion-dollar movies. So we decided to go somewhere else, and we saw a big headline in one of the trade papers that said horror films, I think it was Variety, it was said that horror films were commercially no longer viable. And then Michael Herz and I said, aha, we will go in that area. And but we like comedy a lot, and we like satire, and we love Charlie Chaplin, and we love Preston Sturges, and we love Grand Guignol, and at any rate, his blind significant other is clearly from City Lights. Preston Sturges is responsible in large part for the small town of Tromaville, in which all our movies take place. Marvel Comics is obviously a big influence on me. I've been friends with Stan Lee for 50 years. I've been friends with Roger Corman for 50 years. So many influences on the Toxic Avenger, not the least of which was my wife and I would go camping in 1980, early 80s, and we'd see detritus and unrecycled McDonald's, in fact, non-biodegradable McDonald's garbage everywhere. And we would read a lot of newsletters, one of which had an article about toxic waste dumps ticking away like time bombs all over the world, and pixie dust in Brazil, children running through pixie dust in Brazil, and the pixie dust was in fact radium that was disposed of by hospitals, which had disposed of x-ray machines. So this prompted me to add in this environmental superhero aspect to the Toxic Avenger. He only has a mop. It's not exactly high tech. It's his only weapon. He has a mop, and Toxie can jump. That's it. That's all he can do. By George, Toxie, with no advertising, opened in 1983. Not one theater would play his movie. And by 1985, it was on 2,000 American screens and sold all over the world and became a cartoon show. The Toxic Avenger is the only movie in history in which a young boy's head is squashed by the wheel of an automobile that was made into a children's environmentally correct Saturday morning cartoon show. And this Troma's got a lot of history about it. And this was well before we got into the environment, long before Al Gore invented the internet.
So Return to Nukem High Volume 1 is being toured and premiered across the country. Have you done this sort of thing before, bringing out the movie on the road first?
I'm the hardest working man in the underground. I'm the Willie Loman of the underground filmmaking community.
I read the other day that the film had its world premiere at the Museum of Modern Art. How did that come about?
You stick around long enough and people get it. They have a new curator who is a big Troma fan. And he put Return to Nukem High in a series called The Contenders, what the Museum of Modern Art in New York calls the best movies from around the world, their words, not mine. And in that series was David Lynch, Woody Allen, Coen Brothers, Sofia Coppola, the guy who made the boring movie that won the prize at Cannes. All these, you know, serious filmmakers. And then Lloyd Kaufman in the same group. Not only that, but the American Cinematheque just did a four-decade retrospective for Troma's 40th year, the American Cinematheque in California. And there's a beautiful write-up, a rather intellectual write-up of one film from each decade that was shown in the retrospective that gets what we've been saying in our films. You know, most of the media either ignores us or they only see the sex and violence. They don't see the fact that there's serious filmmaking going on. They can't give us credit for, gee, how is Lloyd Kaufman directing movies for 40 years? Is it just because he's got a lot of naked men running through the woods and he throws ketchup on them and that's it? Is that the secret? Because there are an awful lot of dead bodies of careers where people have tried formulaic movies and they don't last very long.
Lloyd Kaufman. He's the co-founder of Troma Entertainment and has written, directed, or produced many of their films. His do-it-yourself series of books and videos for young filmmakers can be found online, and you'll find lots of Troma-tastic links at WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
I'm David Ford, and it's time for more great music on Triad Arts Weekend. The band Seven Handle Circus has been critically acclaimed as rowdy bluegrass, but you're just as likely to hear them playing an Earth, Wind & Fire classic, rapping with T-Pain and Young Jock, or performing live with Mumford & Sons. The six-piece Atlanta band comes to the Triad this Friday night for Twin City Rib Fest in Winston-Salem. Seven Handle Circus lead banjo player Colin Vinson spoke with me by phone from his home in Atlanta. It used to be that music from the big cities would find its way into rural towns, but today I'm finding a lot of young musicians, you know, in urban areas are drawing from traditional sounds from rural Appalachia and places like that. Why do you suppose that is? What's the draw for you?
I actually grew up about an hour outside of Atlanta in kind of a small town. It was definitely all around there. And I don't know, it's a lot of listening to recordings our parents had and our grandparents, and I don't know, it really makes me feel like a family sort of home thing.
Was there a lot of house music over in the Vinson home?
There was a good bit. My dad raised me on the Who, pretty much, and Paul Simon and that kind of stuff. Not a lot of bluegrass, but a few of us in the band grew up pretty strictly on bluegrass. Troy, for sure, did, the bass player.
It's neat to see the successes you've all had just since 2010, and headlined at Chattanooga, the Nightfall concert series. Nickel Creek and Bella Fleck played there. Just wanted to kind of pick your brains a little bit about what that experience was like and what your takeaway from it was.
Oh, that was amazing. We've always had a blast in Chattanooga. The folks there are just so awesome to us. But yeah, that was really a very awesome, memorable experience. It was one of the bigger crowds we've played to, and they were just super warm and receptive and made it feel like folks enjoyed the music we make.
How does that help you moving forward as a band on the road touring, or does it at all?
Well, for one, it certainly gives us momentum. You know, it makes us feel really confident in what we're doing and want to do it more. But also, shows like that can be a pretty good indicator of kind of the broader appeal of some of our music. We can kind of gauge, you know, maybe this tune we play to a more intimate crowd. Maybe this tune has a broader appeal. So
it's amazing to me that you guys have just been around since 2010 or performing together. This band, Seven Handle Circus, but just 3 years later, Mumford & Sons are inviting you guys to play with them at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. How did that connection happen? And I guess, you know, what sorts of things do you admire about that band?
For one, they're just super nice guys. They're some of the nicest people we've ever met. The way we met was actually a pretty fun story. They were playing at the Fox in the, I think it was a Sunday evening, and we were playing at the brunch spot next door that morning. They just kind of wandered in while we were playing and sat there and watched probably about 2 hours of our set. And they seemed to enjoy it, so they asked us to come play at the Fox with them that night. So afterwards, we hung out and jammed with them in the empty Fox Theater for probably 4 hours.
That's great. In the grand old tradition of jam sessions, that sounds wonderful. Well, I mean, you guys must be likable as well, or they wouldn't have hung out with you for that long. But this is a quote from Jeff, the drummer. He says, a seven-handle show is all about keeping it interesting for the audience and for ourselves. What are some of the ways that you're keeping it interesting for the band, from the band's perspective?
You know, we have a pretty eclectic musical taste, so we really like to incorporate a lot of different styles throughout the show. You know, we might play a blues tune or a jazz tune or a rock tune between a couple of more bluegrassy tunes. And we often throw in a rap song or two somewhere during the set, which keeps it very interesting for us.
That's right. You guys toured with some notable rappers or hip-hop artists not too long ago.
We've actually got a pretty strange list of artists we've played with as a bluegrass band. We opened for T-Pain recently at a Georgia Tech homecoming event. Played with Young Jock.
With Young Jock, I mean, what's the audience response like when they're coming out and you guys open? That's quite a contrast of styles.
It is. But I don't know. These days, you know, the younger folks' taste is definitely getting more eclectic. So it seems to work.
So another tune, and this is the one that I first kicked off with for you all, was Last of My Good Brothers, which is just a great upbeat party tune, drinking tune. Got a lot of coverage on Google. The title is everywhere. What's it feel like when a tune of yours takes off to that degree? And can you tell me how this tune began and worked through it?
We just realized we didn't have any great drinking songs, and that's, you know, it's always been important to a group of folks we hang out with. have a good drinking song. So it started out more kind of straightforward on the beat, and we kind of irised it up as we went. I think that's how drinking songs usually go.
I admire all my brothers who will drink with me. I aspire to outright outlast them all.
And it seemed like that kind of, you know, takes off a little bit, or people start to know it. It's really kind of a strange feeling, because, you know, the first time you're on stage and you see people singing along that you don't know personally, it's very, like, wow, how did that happen? It feels great.
The tune itself, I mean, it really sounds like a great old folk tune that's been sung for, you know, passed down through the generations, which I guess is a good sign. You will not find lots of slow-moving tunes on Whiskey, Stills, and Sleeping Pills, but that's okay. There are some great upbeat tunes, one right after the other, beginning with I've Been Around the World, and just a huge sound from you all, from all of your instruments blazing, but a lot of clarity in the, I'm noticing, in the vocals and harmonies, a lot of great motion with this tune as well. Tell me a little bit about it.
I've Been Around the World was kind of our first single off the Whiskey, Stills, and Sleeping Pills records, and it's one of my favorites to play live. But at the time, most of us were still in school, and we were just trying to figure out how to read the world around us. And so that song kind of came out of that.
Your eyes are tired, your words are a little ahead. Come on now, there, be still and rest your head.
You slow things down nicely with some great fiddle playing and mandolin work in the intro before kicking things into gear with Walking Through the Wilderness. And the hook for this tune has a distinctive pop feel to me. When you mix styles like that, is it ever a conscious decision, or how are some interesting ways that comes about?
Yeah, I'd say it's a conscious decision. Several of us in the band, Sean especially, grew up on a lot of older pop stuff, a lot of Stevie Wonder, a lot of Billy Joel. So he definitely consciously incorporates that into a lot of his songwriting, I think.
Digging ditches for the city ain't bad work if you can get it. When I can, I'll make 40 bucks.
You know, a lot of bands that we really admire don't have necessarily a lead singer. They have several people who trade off vocal duties throughout a record. So I just think that brings something fresh between songs, like, you know, a change that it can certainly change the tone. And for that one, it was definitely, I think, looking for a change of tone a little bit on that one.
It just seems to work so nicely. And you have a very nice, authentic quality, not only to the song, but to the vocal as well, since you're the songwriter and you're going about putting together Alabama Line. How do you know when you've hit it right with that whole, you know, keeping it real, for lack of a better way of saying it, kind of vibe?
Usually you can tell if the song is written pretty quickly. If it's just kind of flowing out of you, just coming out. If you have to sit and think a whole lot on all the words, then maybe you're thinking too hard. That one, I think, was written in my car in about 15 minutes.
So. Do you get a lot of ideas come to you in the car?
For me personally, that's where a lot of my writing happens, or at least starts. You know, I'll get a melody or a line or a verse or something and just roll with it.
Sounds good. Well, Colin, thanks so much for taking time out to chat with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
As the light from curtain's edge appears, soon I fear.
Seven Handle Circus, lead banjo player Colin Vinson. The band performs Friday night, June 6th, beginning at 9 o'clock during Twin City Rib Fest at 500 North Marshall Street in Winston-Salem. Tickets are $7, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. While you're there, you'll find links to Seven Handle's latest LP, Whiskey, Stills, and Sleeping Pills, which debuted at number 10 on the Roots Music Report Bluegrass Chart.
Night, we hide in dreams, far from the day.
I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now. When we return, it'll be world-class visual art on display for free in our own backyard, thanks to Associated Artists. And the Queen of the Night may be angry and taking numbers, but the students at the American Opera Singers Project are loving it. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Dimensions, a 50th anniversary, is a national juried exhibition in the Triad, and it's been presented every year since 1964 by Associated Artists of Winston-Salem. This year's juror is Penland School of Crafts' Jean McLaughlin. The best in show will receive $1,000, $500 for second place, $250 for third, and $50 for honorable mentions. Dimensions, a 50th anniversary, opens this Friday with a free reception at the Milton Rhodes Center for the Arts. Associated Artists of Winston-Salem Executive Director Piers Clarkson spoke with me about this milestone event. He was joined by artist and gallery coordinator Bryce Hauser, who will be curating this national exhibit.
By getting into the competition, you have already won. It is on your track record. You can show it to people. It becomes a milestone in your career to have a national jurid show. For our jurid process, like to become a jurid member of Associate Artists, you have to have two national jurid shows that are outside of Associate Artists in the first place. So having one definitely builds your self-esteem and your career at the same time.
Just deciding who gets in and then who the winners will be, you've got quite an authority on board.
We were so excited to secure Jean McLaughlin. She's been the director at Penland School of Craft since 1998. Prior to that, she served 16 years at the North Carolina Arts Council as the director of visual arts. So she's just simply very, very well respected, not only just in the state of North Carolina, but across the country for her leadership in the arts.
But she's got her work cut out for her because you all received how many submissions
this
year?
Yes, we had 175 artists submit over 700 digital images for Jean to go through and try to select just 50 to 60 pieces to ultimately go into the Dimension show.
Within that, where are they coming from? What kind of reach does the Dimensions exhibit pull from?
Really all across the country. We did have a lot of local and North Carolina entries, but from New York, California. In the past, we've had entries from all around the world. And over the years, since this is our 50th anniversary, we've had thousands of artists enter and hundreds of artists be selected to be in Dimensions shows.
How did Associated Artists fare this time around?
They did very well. Now, I must add that Jean McLaughlin did all of the jurying blindly, so she wasn't aware of who was a member or not of Associated Artists. But of 52 artists that were selected, 20 of the 175 that entered are Associated Artists members, so I was very quietly thrilled for them to make the show.
And then we get to see all these great works for free coming up on Friday. Set the scene for us.
Yeah, it's going to be a great night. We're going to have refreshments, you know, food, wine, and then you walk into the gallery space and you'll see amazing artwork throughout the day. We'll have some good light that comes in, natural light hitting the walls, so that's always the best way of viewing. So I would come early. But even after that, there's a state-of-the-art light. I mean, there's lights in there that are amazing for a gallery. I was very happy to hang my first show there, and it was just a joy to work with.
And in addition to being a gallery coordinator, I'm assuming you're an Associated Artist yourself, Bryce?
Yes, I am a member, yeah.
All right, as a member, what do you get? What's the big deal about Associated Artists?
For one, you get a lot of show opportunities and opportunities to just to get your work into the public, which is what you have to do as an artist. That is the main focus of making art, is to show it to other people. And Associated Artists does that very well. We have all members shows, we have jurid shows, we have national jurid shows like the one that's coming up. And at the same time, we have educational programming every month. We had a painting demo with Linda Weaver where she painted someone from the audience, and it took her about 2 hours, and she did an amazing painting, and everyone got to see the technique and ask questions while she was doing it. It was a great evening, and we have those every month.
Gallery coordinator Bryce Hauser and Associated Artists of Winston-Salem Executive Director Piers Clarkson. Dimensions, a 50th anniversary in the Womble Carlyle Gallery, opens this Friday, June 6th from 5 to 7 with a free reception at the Milton Rhodes Center for the Arts. Associated Artists has a busy summer in store following Dimensions with the July show Summer in the Village at Rinalda Village, followed in August and September by the Legacy's Keener Gallery exhibit and the concluding all-members show in the Womble Carlyle Gallery. You'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to pick up our opera glasses now. The American Singers Opera Project, ASOP, kicked off last weekend with free aria evenings at Arbor Acres in Salem Town in Winston-Salem. The two-week-long program concludes this year with performances of Mozart's Magic Flute, sung in German, with English dialogue and chamber orchestra. Artistic director, American soprano, and assistant professor of music at University of Central Oklahoma, Barbara DeMaio Caprilli, and Wake Forest University professor of music, lyric tenor Richard Hurd, spoke with me about it.
One of the things I was surprised to learn as a pedagogue is that the only thing that affects the sound of the voice, the way the voice sounds, actually, is the pharynx and the size of the mouth. All of the nasal passages that everyone talks about, they just do sympathetic vibrations. But the only thing that actually changes the way the voice sounds is the pharynx, that's a little over 90%, and the shape of the mouth.
And you say pharynx, and I'm thinking of the Sphinx in Egypt. What's a pharynx? And my dad was
pharynx is this part right here.
And you're reaching for, and this is for the radio now, Barbara. So you've got to really spell this out for me.
Basically, think throat.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The vocal filter is what changes the sound of the voice. So everything from the vocal folds up to the lips.
Okay. American Singers Opera Project, AESOP. How did it begin?
It began in New York City and was founded by Nancy Stokes Milnes, who was my voice teacher, with the idea that it was going to copy kind of the thing that Boris Goldovsky used to do with his opera workshop. And the idea is to give singers of all different levels, not just beginners, absolutely all different levels, an opportunity to sing roles that they want to sing.
For those not in the know, Stokes Milnes, a famous name in the world of singing and obviously a famous association with a husband who knew how to sing a tune or two.
Yeah, Nancy Stokes Milnes was the wife of Cheryl Milnes at the time I met her. She is no longer the wife of Cheryl Milnes. He's on his third wife now. But she was with him through much of his career and is a singer herself and was trained in Italy. She had a Fulbright grant and went to Italy to train. Followed Cheryl throughout his career and was the one that gave him notes and helped him when he was making recordings. And one day she decided that she wanted to start coaching roles. And I was coaching roles with her in New York. And then one day she turned to me and said, "I'm tired of putting Band-Aids on problems. I want to start teaching voice." I was one of her first students.
What was your takeaway from your association with her in those lessons? A pearl of wisdom or two that you've taken with you?
Nancy was the first person that I ever met that talked about how the voice is created. So she would be an early proponent of what we now call functional voice training, so that it's not just, you know, pink bubbles and blue numbers or whatever that people talk about, the visualizations. She actually would talk about what the larynx was doing and what the vocal filter was doing. And she's the first person that I really kind of thought, oh, that's why this works. And it really set me on the path, which has brought me to the doctorate that I now have.
That's interesting. I was talking to Ryu Goto, Midori's kid brother, like mm-hmm. 17 years her junior, and he was talking about how important it was for him studying physics, the physics of the violin, and then internalizing the movements, and it really helped him with avoid injury and moving forward with the instrument. I never really considered that. But
we're in the same place now with voice science that sports science was about 20 years ago. And so there are new discoveries being made every day. I went to the Voice Foundation last year and heard some fascinating topics, and it's helping us keep singers healthy longer.
That's something a lot of folks don't realize, Richard. And from my generation, studying in a kind of conservatory setting, music injury is something that's kind of, for years, has been kind of pushed aside. But you've got real concerns. I mean, as a teacher, teaching students to sing in a healthy way.
Exactly. I mean, I have to counsel them a lot of times about staying healthy vocally and what to do and what not to do, you know, to avoid injury to the singing voice. And some of them don't really understand what they need to do to stay healthy.
What are some common things that they're doing wrong?
Singing off the breath, singing off the body, as we both would advocate. Singing incorrectly, not supporting the voice.
Is off the breath, what does that mean?
It's not singing with diaphragmatic effort, with diaphragmatic energy.
When you say diaphragmatic, what are you talking about?
I think it's engaging, you know, all those muscles, intercostal muscles, lower support, and just really letting that help you to support your voice.
Basically, air has to go over the vocal folds to make them vibrate. And when you're talking about a classical sound as compared to a contemporary commercial music sound like belting or musical theater or pop, rock, you need more air because the classical sound is more acoustically efficient. So you can hear a classical sound without a microphone. And for that reason, it needs more air to actually vibrate in the right way. And not only that, there are a lot of people sing with a lot of neck and tongue tension. That's one of the major things you see in American singers. And that type of thing can also get in the way of making a healthy sound. And I love, we have Lita Scarce, who comes from the Voice Foundation at Duke every year. And she always talks about how to sing on a vocal clock so that you're making sure that you don't sing full out all the time. It's a fascinating talk on vocal health, and our singers always get a lot out of it. But it's a difficult thing because people say vocal abuse. Well, vocal abuse, as Lita likes to say, we don't say knee abuse when a football player or a basketball player hurts their knee. What happens is sometimes singers get injured. It's because it's a very high contact sport. And no matter how good your technique is, sometimes things happen. And we often talk about how the back opens when you're taking a breath, that all of those intercostal muscles take the ribs and open them up. And then the Italians call it singing in apnea, singing while holding your breath, so that you sing with that chest open in that position, and the diaphragm stays down, and the air comes out of the lungs more efficiently.
My thanks to American Singers Opera Project Artistic Director, American soprano Barbara DiMaio Caprilli, and Wake Forest University Professor of Music, lyric tenor Richard Hurd. The two-week-long program concludes this year with performances of Mozart's Magic Flute. It'll be sung in German with English dialogue and chamber orchestra June 12th through the 14th at 7 o'clock in Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake Forest University campus. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Michaela Nance. If you missed part of today's show, you'll find it along with archived episodes, podcasts, photos, and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We'd love to hear from you as well. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions, please drop us an email to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Triad Arts Speak. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.